ahead. It is Tuesday, November 26th, 2 days till Thanksgiving. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I don't even remember what the weather is like out there because I got in here so early to take a show for Wednesday, to do an opening for Thursday for Thanksgiving. And I said to Ken, I got off the air taping and I curled into a ball on the floor and I went, I am so burnt out. Please, God, do an okay interview today because these are people I really, really, and not that I don't care about every guest, but today's guests are remarkable. I've interviewed both of them in the past and to bring them both back on is pretty exciting. So, and we're going to be dedicating today's show. I will read Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's opening statement again two more times today and tomorrow. But in a way, today's show is dedicated to him because it's dedicated to those people who selflessly serve and serve with dignity and honesty and integrity and speak the truth. And we saw a lot of that in the last couple of days through the impeachment hearings. And it makes me proud to be an American. It made me proud. I felt very patriotic as I heard them talking. You know, you don't put a little flag pin on your lapel and think that you're a patriot. You speak truth, and that's how I know. Anyway, on this Tuesday, November 26th, Mr. Barnes, what have you been noticing?
Well, I noticed the weather.
Okay, thank you.
It's very nice.
It's a very nice. Okay, I don't even remember.
I'll just pick up where you left off.
Hi, Judge. Okay.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the economy, which the punditry says is doing so well, and therefore Donald Trump is going to benefit by it in the next election.
Yep.
David Brooks, who is well-respected, even though he's kind of conservative, says that it's such a strong economy. Mm-hmm. It's the what we all hope for. But really, the question is, how do we define a strong economy? And kind of like Elizabeth Warren says, who's it good for? Who's it working for? It's working for the wealthy and the corporations, not working so well for working people.
604 billionaires, I think, in the United States.
But right.
Keep going. They're doing amazingly well.
And the normal looks at the economy do is they look at GDP growth, which is the gross domestic product, all the goods and services our country produces. That's increasing at a small but healthy rate, a low unemployment rate. It's currently at 3.6%. That sounds good. Jobs added. But the standard employment rate doesn't include anybody who has given up searching for work after 4 weeks, the discouraged workers. So it only looks at people who have been searching for work within the past 4 weeks. If you've searched and searched for 3 months and decided you are just not getting anything and you give up searching, they don't even count you as one of the people. So that's a bunch of people. Then there's the underemployed, people who can't get jobs working as much as they want or at the level they want. So if I got fired from my law firm and took a job flipping burgers, I'm considered not unemployed in the unemployment rate. But I'm underemployed because I'm not doing as much as I can do job-wise given my training. Also, the involuntary part-time workers, people who can't get a full-time job.
I got 4 jobs.
Yeah.
So and I'm still not up to like 40 hours a week.
Right. So like even if you're working 1 hour a week or 5 hours a week at some low minimum or something like that wage, you're not counted as unemployed. So this low unemployment rate is missing millions of people.
Right.
So low unemployment is – it doesn't really mean that normal people are benefiting. Then there's how much people are getting paid.
Yeah.
If you just look at the fact that people are employed, they're all flipping burgers and not making ends meet, not able to – paying more than half their income for rent, paying 60-70% of their income for rent like a lot of people do, then – it counts in the big economic picture that David Brooks and Trump look at. It seems like, oh, the economy is doing fine. But for folks like that, it's not doing so fine because they can't support their families. These two research economists named Lawrence Katz and Alan Krueger found that 94% of job growth in the last 10 years, well, from 2005 to 2015 that they looked at data for, has been in precarious alternative work arrangements, even though we're in the gig economy. So people are freelancing, they're doing independent contracting, they're doing temp work for corporations like Uber. Mm-hmm. Are you going to make ends meet doing that? Maybe if you work 70 hours a week. So saying the economy is doing well or not doing well really depends on how you define the economy doing well. And if you define it just as corporate America making a lot of money, then our economy is doing fine.
Well, look
if
what
you
happened.
Ask ordinary people, how are you doing? Are you worried about paying your bills?
Look what happened with the tax cuts, where we gave an enormous tax cut to corporate America. And the idea was that they would do it. They would increase salaries. They would increase investment in capital, investments like they would build new factories. That instead, what they do, they did stock buybacks. That they, in fact, the amount of investment in structure in workers went down. I mean, it's dreadful. It's dreadful. Again, you have to ask the question, and I think Elizabeth Warren does it, and a number of candidates do it. You know, what is an economy for? If an economy is only going to be about the stock market and the billionaires, then it's not about us. And ultimately, that's the test of an economy: is have you addressed inequality? Are people healthy? Are people educated? Do people have a place to live that's warm at night? I mean, that's the test of an economy, not Wall Street. But how many people are living on the street? That's the street I care about. Are you living on the street, or are you only looking at Wall Street? And we have to take a look at those two different streets because they're remarkably different.
Exactly.
And one doesn't care about the other. And I know which one.
Right. And so the public really has to be smart and ask smart questions.
Yep.
So when people like Donald Trump come around in campaign season next year and say, vote for me because the economy is doing great, you ask him who it's doing great for. And it's not doing so great for me.
Right.
You know, the long-term trend is that wages are not keeping up with the prices of things that we need. Essential services have improved a little bit, but not as much as the cost does.
Take a look at rents.
Yeah.
Take a look at rents.
Minimum wage workers can't afford a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the United States, according to Economic Policy Institute reports in 2018.
$7.25 an hour. What can you afford?
Yeah. So they can't afford a two-bedroom apartment.
They can't afford a
one-bedroom.
What
if they have kids?
That's one of the reasons why we have a choice. We can look to welfare to complete the package. Here are people working full-time that are still going to need food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Here are people working full-time that are still going to need Section 8 housing. Here are people working full-time and still needing Medicaid. So what are we doing? Are we basically sustaining them, or are we allowing the companies that hire them at $7.25 an hour to make all this money?
So just one last point, and that is that a study found that if the minimum wage increased – no, as much as productivity has increased since the 1960s, not it steps upon its own. If the minimum wage kept up with the amount of productivity, that's how much goods and services each worker produces. Since the 1960s, the minimum wage would be $20 an hour now. So that is, companies have been getting $20 an hour worth of services
at $7.25
from
an
people,
hour.
And they're paying $7.25.
Right.
That
disgusting.
Is unbelievable.
It's disgusting. All right, this is our second to last day where I am reading the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who served this country with honor and honesty. He part of his testimony was the following: "The uniform I wear today is that of the United States Army. The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. We do not serve any political party. We serve the nation. I am humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I have ever known. As a young man, I decided I want to spend my life serving this nation. It gave my family refuge from authoritarian repression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this great country. Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life in the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer life. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history and story in America. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions. And offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I am grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago, and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where we can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. This is the part where I was just completely falling apart watching the TV. Dad, I am sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. It is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union, come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. I have one more day of reading this before Thanksgiving. I have read it every day since he uttered those words during his testimony. I have never been so proud to be an American as listening to him or listening to Dr. Fiona Hill. It was those people that came here out of choice. It's those people that defend our right to live and live safe and live in truth. Oh, my God, what an amazing, amazing last couple of weeks it was. So I have dedicated today's show to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, in part because our two guests actually talk about military service, both of whom I've talked to in the past, so this is a return performance for them. Our first guest is retired Major General Dennis Leitch. He is the author of a book, Skin in the Game, Poor Kids and Patriots. He sent me two articles from a public statement that they made as these hearings are going on. Oh, Dennis, I feel so bad for you. The competition was so great. But the two articles you sent me reflect what you were saying in this public forum that you held in Washington, D.C. The first one was entitled, A Military Draft to Confront Climate Change. A critic of U.S. militarism nonetheless suggests we can force skin in the game while tackling a coming global crisis. The second article, Rising Costs, Dwindling Recruit Numbers, Increasing Demands May Bring Back the Military Draft. So let me welcome back for his return performance, Major General Dennis Leitch. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, these last couple of weeks have been pretty remarkable for you as well, as we're talking about holding these hearings, and you were there to hold a public forum on looking at the return of the draft. I guess before we start talking about that, I would love to get your thoughts about the impeachment hearings. I'd love to get your thoughts on what you're seeing and hearing in the last couple of weeks, because for a lot of us who are sort of, I don't know, somewhat skeptical, I think, of the military, somewhat skeptical of the quote-unquote deep state, always wondering about really what do those bureaucrats do and, you know, why should we respect them, you must have been pretty proud.
I was, absolutely. I think that the courage that they demonstrated as professionals in the national security realm was absolutely stunning, and I'm very proud of them and proud to be part of that cadre.
Yeah, I'm, and in a lot of ways, I almost think they're a great backdrop for you as you talk about looking at the return of the draft. Because as I said to people afterwards, if I could redo my life at age 17, I'd want to follow those people. I would want them to follow them into the military. I would have wanted to follow them into the State Department. I would have wanted to do that because what they did, I thought, was not only so important but so incredibly worthwhile as well. And I think it was a wonderful opportunity. And before we get into your public forum that you held last week, I believe it was, I was listening to Doris Kearns Goodwin speaking on MSNBC this morning. I don't know if you got to hear her.
I did.
Did you hear her talking about the idea of she wanted some kind of she didn't necessarily say the return of the draft, but she talked about the idea of sort of this collective service that we all have to give back. And one of the reasons why she was saying that was that she also saw that as an opportunity to provide us with the Velcro that we need more than ever of making us a stronger nation, a nation that sort of understands each other and is willing to listen to each other as well, as opposed to tearing each other apart. So as I was listening to Doris, I was thinking, what a perfect day to talk to Dennis. So Dennis, talk to us a little bit about your concerns, because you really are worried about all volunteer force. What it means, how it distances us collectively from the consequence of war, and how it may not be producing the kind of military we need.
Well, let me just correct you a little bit. I think the predicate question to a return to the draft is whether the all-volunteer force is working and will work in the future based on fairness, efficiency, and sustainability, and also whether it contributes to the civil-military gap and to the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. I think that all of those questions are important, but the simple question of return to the draft, I think, is premature.
Okay.
But first, you have to answer the question, is the all-volunteer force fair, efficient, and sustainable? And does it contribute to that civil-military gap and the militarization of U.S. foreign policy?
So you have 15 minutes to answer that question. So go through that list and tell us what you see is working or is not working, which will then rise to the next level of what do we need to do?
Well, it's unfair in that 330 million Americans lay claim to rights, liberties, and security that not a single one of them is obligated to protect and defend. The fact of the matter is that national security and military service falls on less than 1% of the U.S. population, and that's predominantly in the third and fourth socioeconomic quintiles of the country, and the first socioeconomic quintile is AWOL. The efficiency argument is one that you really have to wonder. If it's an all-volunteer force, why do we have to pay somebody to volunteer? Last year, we paid $429 million in enlistment bonuses to induce people to come into our Army. And the sustainability issue stems from the cost. We spend more than $700 billion on quote-unquote defense, but it's for a country that's $23 trillion in debt and running deficits of $1 trillion a year, it's very difficult to sustain that. So my sense is that without question that the all-volunteer force is not working based on those parameters and also contributes to that civil-military gap that you alluded to, and also contributes to the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. You know, I often ask audiences when I speak, if in 2005 we had implemented a fair across-the-board draft, men and women, no exemptions, no deferments, how long would we have stayed in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Exactly.
It's much too easy for the National Command Authority to commit troops to faraway places that don't have any real impact on national defense, and for Congress to abdicate its role as the power that can declare war.
So you're asking this question. You've been asking this question on and off for a long time. I guess my question to you is the Pentagon asking that question?
No.
And why not? Because do they want the license to be able to sort of continue to support these wars? And their concern is if you bring others in, questions may be raised, and they prefer not to be challenged?
All of those things, plus the fact of the matter is, but the last thing a senior uniformed bureaucrat in the Pentagon wants to do is put an issue on the Congress's desk that is a difficult political question, and they're beholden to Congress for their promotion list and their budgets.
So you did something very interesting, which I think caught a lot of people's attention. You connected this concern about the U.S. military to climate change. Why did you thread those two together?
Well, Larry Wilkerson, my colleague on the panel, took the lead in that. But there are a couple of issues that are important with regard to climate change in the military. The first one is that climate change jeopardizes the U.S.-based military installations and renders them, in some cases, inoperable. We saw last year both Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida and Offutt Air Force Base be rendered inoperable by a hurricane and flooding. And if we have the sea rise that we are often told is inevitable with the melting of the ice sheets in the Arctic, many of the installations that are coastal-based are inoperable.
Right.
The other one is that climate change will have an effect throughout the world when you talk about drought, crop failures, famine, and migration, and create opportunities or obligations that for stability operations to deal with failed states and ungovernable spaces and leading to terrorism. So climate change has impact on the U.S. military in those two areas, And as we see greater requirements for defense support for civilian authorities, as we've seen in the United States, we'll have higher demands on the military.
Well, you know, my understanding is that if that there is one thing that the Pentagon is actually sort of focusing on, is that they are aware of climate change. They are aware of the consequences of climate change. So if they are so aware, then how can they continue to embrace the all-voluntary military when they realize with the conversation we just had before this conversation, it wasn't working for them, it was costing too much, it wasn't producing the numbers that they need because they have to give all these kinds of bonuses, it wasn't offering us the kind of Velcro I think we need as a society to hold us together where we're all obligated. But more importantly, if they're being honest about climate change, they know damn well that the current all-volunteer force is going to not assist them, but in fact undermine their ability to respond.
Well, they have a, they have a conflicted set of priorities. They're trying to operate as best they can inside a system that where the Trump administration has said that climate change is not an issue and it's doesn't exist, and operating more effectively than most of the other arms of government with regard to climate change. They're not ignoring it and proceeding with the responsibility that they have to win the nation's wars and protect the homeland.
So Sir Wilkerson said the following, quote, "A crisis of unknown proportions is riding down the road on us, and the risk is high enough to take insurance. You can't get ready for this crisis without a whole lot of people to handle it." And then he continues to say, "As much as I may have a fear of the DOD becoming so instrumental in meeting what might be the worst crises the world ever confronted, I still understand that they're the only ones with the capability," he said, pointing to military ships, planes, logistics, and response expertise in past crises. Quote, "The military are the only ones with the organization and discipline to handle this." This is so interesting, Dennis, because a lot of people will be like, oh, my God, the military is the only one. But I'm trying to think about, you know, his answer to that. I'm going, what would the alternative be if we are facing a crisis of, you know, immeasurable proportions? Today, the UN just issued another report that says things are getting worse faster than we ever anticipated. And it is really hard for like a lefty like myself to suddenly realize that if I have to look for a response, the response may be to something that, for the at least historically, I've been almost afraid of and I've never felt an invitation into.
Well, the fact of the matter is that based on our recent past and our history, the military is the only organization that we've used to deal with these kinds of crises and is uniquely capable of doing it. But it will be stretched with these multiple missions of fighting the nation's wars, preparing to fight wars, and at the same time, dealing with these kinds of crises, both in the homeland and throughout the world.
In one of the articles, you talked about ready and willing to participate.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about the willing piece, because you responded in a way that was somewhat negative.
Well, it is negative. I mean, if you look at, you know, everyone wrings their hands about the fact that only 30% of those 18 to 24-year-olds in the United States can meet the minimum enlistment requirements. But the fact of the matter is that as a result of that, last year the Army gave 10 to 12% of those they enlisted waivers from various quote-unquote standards, and also enlisted 1.9% of the force as Cat 4s. And Cat 4s are those recruits who score between the 10th and 31st percentile on the Army Aptitude Test. They have been demonstrated, a 2005 RAND study said that they perform 10 to 30% less effectively than their higher scoring counterparts. So the fact is that 4 million people turn 18 in the United States every year, right, only 30% of whom are qualified to serve in the military. And everyone wrings their hands over that. But that says that there are 1.2 million, 1,200,000 who are qualified to serve. The fact is, though, that only 15% are willing to serve. That gets you down to 180,000.
Right.
Every year, the five services need to recruit about 150,000 in order to regenerate the force. But what that says is that there are 1,020,000 young people who are able to serve but unwilling. And in that group of 1,020,000, I suspect there are a lot of high school valedictorians and National Merit Scholars who would make great cyber warriors and intel technicians,
right,
and also a few all-conference linebackers who would make great infantrymen but don't even consider the military. The fact is we have enough to serve and meet standards, but we are unwilling to tap into that.
Wow. The operative word, willing, or in this case, unwilling. The articles that Dennis sent me were rising costs, dwindling recruit numbers, increasing demands may bring back the military draft. And the other article was about the connection between this and climate change. I think you need to read these articles. I think it's a sobering moment. And as we look at the change in 2020, these are the kinds of things that we need to actually talk about. There's an urgency of the moment. Maybe looking at our military is part of that conversation. Thank you so very much, Major General Dennis Leitch. You are also the author of Skin in the Game, Poor Kids and Patriots. What a great title. Thank you again.
Great to be with you. Have a great Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, you too. Ciao. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1829. That was the day that William Silvis was born in Armagah, Pennsylvania. Growing up, he was one of 12 children. His father was a wagon maker and taught him the trade. At the age of 18, he became an ironworking apprentice. His skills took him to Philadelphia, where he found work. But ironwork was changing. More and more foundries were hiring unskilled labor, or helpers, to assist in production. They could pay these workers significantly less and undercut the wages of the skilled iron molders. In response, William joined his local iron molders union. But he knew if they were to really have any power as workers, they would need to join together with other locals. In 1863, he brought together 21 locals to form the Iron Molders International Union. 3 years later, he embarked on an even more ambitious project, forming a national labor organization for workers across the trades. Under his leadership, the National Labor Union grew to 300,000 members strong. William shared his thoughts on the importance of labor in a speech to the Iron Molders Union in 1864, saying, quote, "If working men and capitalists are equal co-partners, composing one vast firm by which the industry of the world is carried on and controlled, why do they not share equally in the profits? Why does capital take to itself the whole loaf, while labor is left to gather up the crumbs? Why does capital roll in luxury and wealth, while labor is left to eke out a miserable existence in poverty and want?" Sadly, after all these years, William's questions are still being asked today. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Wind whipping across the Great Plains can generate a lot of electricity, but transporting that electricity from remote areas to cities and towns can be a big task.
And it's not something that can be solved on an individual state basis or an individual company basis.
Nick Brown is CEO of Southwest Power Pool. It oversees the electricity grid in parts of 14 states, including Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma. In April, the organization briefly generated more than 65% of its power from wind, a national record for a regional grid operator. Brown says it took a lot of work to get to that point. Utilities invested $10 billion on transmission projects across the region, and it's required complex coordination between different utilities to send the wind power to where it's needed at any given moment. But Brown says Southwest Power Pool's success shows utilities can transition to less polluting sources of power.
It is imperative that this industry, and quite frankly, the whole U.S. economy, move to a net zero carbon situation. We just have to move in that direction.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, miss a war. That until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, this a war.
All right, everyone, we are back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arnaz and Ken Barnes. The title of the song is War. It is sung by?
Sung by Bob Marley, yeah. One of my favorites.
Well, as I mentioned before, I'm dedicating today's show to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, a patriot, someone with honor and distinction, someone who made me feel proud to be an American. We started with the whole question of the all-voluntary military with General Laich, and now we look at a picture book. Joining me, as he's done before, is Richard Cahan?
It is. It
okay,
is, Ernie.
Richard, I'm so tired. If you knew about this morning, you would understand. My mind is fried. But what I love about what you do is that you take these long-lost photo collections that people had taken pictures in earnest, wanted to make sure that the things that they saw were documented, and then they kind of disappeared. So the whole purpose and the raison d'etre for why they took those pictures seemed to evaporate in time. And you've gone back and you've pulled them together and you put together these masterful books that you can't take your eyes off of, even as you want to avert your eyes. And the first time I interviewed you, you wrote a book called Un-American. And it was a book of photos from the Japanese internment camps. And I don't know if I've told you this, but about a dozen times a year, I have to find that book, and I have to put it on my coffee table, and I have to invite people in and say, this is who we are today. We're un-American. And that book just reminds me of the tragedy of our history and the tragedy of our present. You have a new book out, and it's entitled Aftershock: The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. And I don't think even a lot of people understood that there were people that had that sort of title. They didn't carry a weapon. They carried, you know, a piece of equipment to take a picture.
Right.
And tell me about where they were stored. What was the point? Did anyone ever take these pictures and pull them together and show them to us? Or are they just taken and then filed away until you and your fellow authors found them and put them together in this remarkable book? Because we kind of know about war and death, but we never really confront the pictures and the toll.
Right. Well, I think the book is really a gift. The men, and they all were men, who were who went into the army. They were made into army photographers, and they were given a gun. They were given a camera instead of a gun, basically, to face the enemy. And they created something I think that was very important for future generations. By photographing the end of the war and really documenting what the world looked like in 1945 was to give people in the future an idea of what total war means, and some of these pictures have been shown before. There are books about the end of concentration camps. There's certainly books about the end of the war and the Battle of the Bulge and the bombing of Dresden and obviously Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I don't think anyone's ever did a story, did a book about 1945 through photographs, and that's what really interested us.
Well, and I think you've just said something. So we've had these sort of chapters, these windows in, and we've seen some of these pictures. But as you point out in the piece that you actually wrote for, I think, an old paper, the Chicago Sun-Times, you wrote, "There are photos of ravaged cities, the last days of concentration camps, of prisoners, desperate refugees scouring the landscape for food and shelter, our testimony against war." And really what you've done in this book is you've actually put together the meaning of total war. That's the power of this book. It isn't one piece. It's taking all those pieces of that puzzle and showing you the horrific picture and the horrific consequences, which is why this book is so important and so necessary. Because as you point out, no one has ever done this. A pox on us for not having done it sooner.
Yeah, I think that war has become easy for many Americans. Certainly not easy for the people who fight, the soldiers who fight in wars in the Middle East, and their families and their loved ones. But for people who don't have that connection, it seems, in the words of our president, it seems very far away, and it's very isolated, and it's somewhat easy. But war can become all-encompassing. We're connected to so many different countries and causes, and this is really a book about what happens when war becomes total. Most of the people who lived in Europe were starving, or were needing of food. Many became refugees. Many became killed. In 1945, there's estimates that up to 60 million people in the war were killed, and there were more civilians than soldiers. And this book really documents that toll on big populations.
So are any of these photographers still alive? As you put this book together, how did you make the choices? There's one picture in here, I have to find it, that I keep going back to, because to me it speaks volumes about our inhumanity. And this is the picture. It says, "Frozen in an awful moment are the ashen remains of a prisoner murdered by the Nazis." You have to see this picture, everyone. It is just, I opened the book and I'm like, oh my God, what is this? And you write that the SS troops set fire to a large barn on the outskirts of Gardelegen in northern Germany that was full of Soviet, French, Polish, and Jewish prisoners. Those who desperately burrowed under the walls of the burning barn to escape were shot by the SS. And then you continue to go, but then at the end, before these you saw stories were propaganda, but now you know they weren't. There are the bodies, and all those guys are dead. And he's frozen. Look at this picture. I'm showing this to Ken. So how did you make the decision as to what photographs you would choose? Did you talk to any of these soldier photographers if they're still alive? And did they assist you in understanding what not only what you were looking at, or did they just have enough documentation that not only were they in the files, but the stories that underpin them were also part of that file?
Right. Unfortunately, every photographer in the book is no longer living. Right. This 1945 is the 75th anniversary of the end of the war, and these photographers were generally 20, 25, some were 30 years old, so they would all be
dead.
At least 95.
Yeah.
Very few are alive, unfortunately.
Yeah, of course.
But we were given a chance to look through Army records, and they wrote a lot during, they produced what's called morning reports every single day about what they saw and what they did. Mm-hmm. Many of them produced really beautiful memoirs, sometimes that just with their families, and sometimes they shared them on those memoirs. I think we looked through at least almost a dozen of them. We talked to their children, who both are proud of their fathers and unknowing of exactly what they went through. I don't think that they realized the gift that they were giving. I think that mostly they were thinking about how to live another day and how to eat but they took their work very seriously, and they risked their lives. They oftentimes almost got between the front lines of American troops and German troops and troops all over the world, and they knew this was important work.
You know, we had just talked to Lieutenant General Dennis Leitch, and he was talking about the fact that there is this disconnect between our society and war, like less than 1% participate. It's the same people. They tend to be in the lower, you know, quintile of the U.S. population, that we're actually almost dumbing down the expectation we have of who serves in the military. And one of his concerns is that because we are – this all-volunteer military has produced the kind of really pathetic low numbers that we really don't have an understanding because it isn't us. It's somebody else's kid. It's the same kid. It's in a place that we don't have connection to. In a lot of ways, what I think about this book is that it needs to be shown in every high school in America, that this isn't a book for a coffee table. This is a book for a 10th grader. Mm-hmm. It's a book for an 11th grader. Because again, you know, we may see it on TV, but this these are pictures of consequences that I think most of us can't even envision, but we need to see in order to understand.
Arnie, you understand this book really well. We had a lot of – some of the pictures could be classified as gruesome. We feel that all the pictures are filled with humanity. But we didn't flinch in showing some of the pictures because, as you say, these high school students one day may be fighting, or yes, they could be drafted if we ever go back to that, into a war, and they should know what they're getting involved in. This country should know what it's getting involved in.
You have a wonderful quote by Charles Sumner, and he says, "Sometimes war has meaning, and sometimes it has none. However, there is one constant. Those who suffer the most have nothing to gain from its outcome and had nothing to do with starting it." And that's just it's such a tragic statement. And it just feels like that needs to be heard as you look at the consequences. And I think we have to realize the kind of fodder. And what I was thinking about after my first interview was that, you know, as we dumb down our military in order to accommodate this all-volunteer military, giving them bonuses, doing anything to attract them, even though we know that 70% of them don't even meet the basic standards, we're actually making them even more vulnerable because we're making our military even more vulnerable. And then you look at these pictures, and this was at a time when everybody was serving. Everybody had some skin in this game, and that meant that they were losing. But I think the idea of those pictures are so powerful because unless you see them now, you don't understand what they saw and what I think must have frightened them, which is why they never shared them with their family. My family never talked about the war. Never, ever, ever. I would have loved to have had the pictures and sat down with my grandfather and said, "Talk to me about this."
Right. One of the nice things about these men was that they didn't talk about the war. You're absolutely right, but they also left something behind to talk for them.
Yeah.
Whether they were young and whether they were that profound to understand, you know, to understand it, I'm not sure.
So you published this book and you said that it's not a traditional war book, that it's about the waning days of World War II, that instead of doing the action shots, you did the desolation, you did the despair, you did the consequences. I mean, that's what makes this book so incredibly powerful, is that most of what we know about the military, I mean, what did Donald Trump, he just awarded a dog a medal, you know, but he was attracted and seduced by the action. And that is, in a lot of ways, very seductive. It's very machismo. What I see in this book, I will say it's very maternal because I feel like as someone who's the caregiver, who's asked to pick up the pieces, this is a book about pieces.
I agree with you. That's exactly what this book is all about. It's an anti-war book, kind of disguised as a war book.
What it reminds me of,
oh my God,
can I just say, I was a kid, and the only image, of course, that I had of war was like, Arnie, you were just talking about with the action
shots
and the grandeur and the bravery and, you know, like a picture with, what's his name from California, Clint Eastwood or somebody, you know.
Yeah. Right.
But I remember reading All's Quiet on the Western Front and seeing in my mind pictures like these of what it's really like and being scared to death of death and the horrors of it, and made me realize that it's not quite as simple as all just like a brave war movie.
Well, and what I'm, you said that you spoke to the families, because obviously the photographers are dead. At the 75th year of the anniversary. So those that did share stories, what stories did they share with you?
You know, they shared that their fathers loved photography. You know, that they were at this was the great photo story of the century, but that most of them didn't want to do any photography after the war because they had in a sense seen it all.
Yeah.
And so many of them became associated with photography. They became printers and engravers, and one became a life photographer, but one became, you know, publishers, journalists. You know, so they were still interested in people, but they didn't want to use their camera. They had, you know, and oftentimes they used their camera for fun. And interestingly, my father is mentioned in the book. I think everybody of our generation has a connection to World War II. But when I was a boy, we used to walk through my neighborhood of Chicago, and there was a statue of a soldier with a hand grenade in one hand and a rifle in the other hand. And I asked him, so is this what, you know, as a little boy, was this what war was like? And he said, no, he was actually a doctor. So he didn't care. And I said, you didn't carry a gun? You didn't carry a hand grenade? Right. You know, and as it turns out, he treated about 150 women who were on a months-long death march, Jewish women, and left in a barn in Czechoslovakia. And he helped, help them. He was smart enough to know that they shouldn't be fed. It would seem obvious that, you know, actually one of the soldiers slipped one of the women a piece of chocolate, and she died just a couple of hours later. Wow. And, you know, to me that was more, as I got much older, my disappointment in my father for not carrying a gun, you know, lessened. And actually some of the women wrote my mother, who was a young bride at the time, notes about my father and how important he was in their lives. So
think of, I mean, again, carrying a gun isn't about saving a life. Mm-hmm. And what your father did was save lives. You know, we think about war as a winner and a loser. All right. And that the winners, you know, not only do they win and they vanquish the opposition, but they've saved us. What your father did without a gun was save a lot of people.
Right. Right.
You know, and in some ways he rises to the top of the charts as opposed to who didn't carry a gun.
And ultimately, for people who are in this war, it's all about losing. You know, that's even if you're a winner, you can see from these pictures that these men came back very shaken. You know, how they ever, you know, became regular day-to-day citizens is still remarkable to me.
So, Richard, where are these photographs kept?
They're all at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland.
What's the gate? Who's the gatekeeper here? Can anybody walk in?
Anybody?
Oh my God!
They all belong to us, and amazingly, and they're very friendly, and you know, you literally fill out a little pass, and within 15 minutes, you are a researcher. And you can go to the what's called the Still Pictures branch, and they allowed us, and this was kind of special. Well, it wasn't special because they allow everyone to do this now. But you can actually take the original negatives that were taken in the field, and you can scan 10 of them a day, and that's what we did. And that's why these pictures look so unusual, because scanners. Negatives are filled with photographic information, and these are, you know, really large negatives that were 4 inches by 5 inches.
Wow.
And scanners love information, and that's why they look very different. Some of the pictures have been seen before, especially the pictures of the end of the concentration camps, but you've never seen them looking like this, because those pictures were printed in the analog days of an enlarger, and these pictures are all digitized, and you see everything that the camera saw.
So these were photographs done by soldiers. That was they were given a camera, and that was their responsibility was to photograph and capture all these things.
Exactly. Some of them were professional photographers, and some of them had just written down in some paper or told someone they were interested in photography, and they learned photography, you know, in America, and they were sent to Europe or Asia with a camera.
So you must have the names of all these photographers. So here's my question. Did any of them write afterwards? Did any of them write a novel? Did they write an article?
Did they write letters?
Or a letter? I'm kind of curious as to, as you compose this book, not only did they photograph, but they obviously had to react. And some people react by being very quiet or by running away. Others react because they have to sort of, it's almost cathartic. They need to put it down on paper, not just what they filed every day, but after the fact, when they got home, they needed to sort of reflect on what happened. Who were those that reflected that you were able to sort of tap into?
Yes, I mean, there's about 12 of them that either wrote letters to the editor, and they were always letters against the brutality of war, or left behind memoirs, and many of them published them in vanity presses, and their daughters or their sons would direct me to them, or they would send me the books, and it's what they saw they thought was important to share with the world, and as you pointed out, Charles Sumner, and he oh has several God. Quotes in the book.
Yeah.
They were very profound, very thoughtful.
So what's been the reaction to this book? This book came out just about a month ago.
Yeah.
Where have you been going? I mean, I'm part of me initially thinks that you go into a lot of nursing homes. And the reason, and don't take this the wrong way, but these are people who will not necessarily there's this level of familiarity because in some ways it was closer to that them and their experience because it was their fathers or their grandfathers, and there may have been sort of an intimacy and an immediacy. And then I would love to have, you know, the thought of you going into college campuses, but I'm just trying to figure out how has the response been and who's your audience?
You know, I feel like my audience is everyone. I'm not a very good marketer. I think this book is important to 18-year-olds, I think this is important to people who lived through the war. We spoke 2 weeks ago at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. They invited us back. And I just got a Facebook post this morning of a woman who bought the book at the National Archives and was on the bus going home, and she was sharing the pictures with a soldier now, and they were discussing, you know, war.
Yep.
So, I think war is, unfortunately, an important part of many of our lives. We probably, you know, I was thinking society, you have much more of a chance of dying in a war, even during peaceful times, that war could happen one day, or rebellion than any other thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a book for everyone to reflect on.
Excuse me, have you asked or shown this to people who are veterans today? I mean, new veterans, not of World War II, but
like the
Vietnam,
woman on the bus, like the woman
Vietnam,
on the bus talking
right.
to the guy.
Or Iraq right. or Afghanistan, and do they relate to it? Is it the same, or is there a difference?
We've gotten one letter from somebody who said that at West Point, he took courses in the impact of war, and that this was very important to soldiers to learn about.
Right.
And so somebody said to me recently that that it was a very liberal book, and I said, I don't think so. I think conservatives and liberals, soldiers and non-soldiers, all see the terrible problems of war.
So wait a minute, is it to be conservative is to be denying?
I mean, I think liberals and conservatives both realize that war is a terrible thing. I don't think it's a liberal thought or a conservative thought. Someone said that I would be classified as a radical, and I think that's wrong. I think I'm classified as somebody who cares, and that most people care about.
Well,
this issue.
But see, you know what this scares me? This scares me because the idea of being radical is about revealing the truth, and what this book is about the truth. You know
right.
that. That
right.
that's what makes it so hard, because you know in a lot of ways you want to sometimes cocoon yourself from the truth,
right.
and you don't want to address the facts. And what is so powerful about this book is that it isn't about most of the stories and most of the picture books, which is the soldiers, you know, mounting the parapets or doing whatever.
Right.
It's what happens when it's over.
Yes.
You know, it's the death and destruction and the pieces and the starvation and all those things. And that is the sobering part that we
Absolutely.
Never want to talk about. We don't want to talk about what happens after. It's the win and then it's done, as if it's a switch. And what this book is such a powerful statement of truth, you know. And what's scaring me now in the time of political times we live in is that I'm not sure are we in a post-truth, a post-fact society? God help us if we are. Because
right.
that's another reason why this book is so important, is that both it's sobering and it forces us to face the facts. And that's why I love what you do.
Well,
and
thank you.
And at Thanksgiving I'll have Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, on one side of my table, and on the other side of my table I will have Un-American, and people will look at me like, "What's your problem, Arnie?" And my problem is I don't want these repeated.
Absolutely.
That's my problem. Mm-hmm. My problem is I'm so glad you go into the archives, a place I would never go, that you know that you have the right photographer's eye to understand what you're looking at. And then not only do you pick the right pictures, but you tell the best story in pictures.
Well,
so thank you, Richard, so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I urge everyone to consider this as a Hanukkah gift or a Christmas gift or, hell, any kind of a gift. Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. It's a gift that will actually maybe ensure life. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, ciao. I will bring in the book Un-American. You have to see that. I have pictures on it. Last Christmas, I had it on my Christmas table. That's what I put in. Every guest that came in said, wow, this is different. And I said, no, look at it.
Well, I'm just stunned that somebody, conservative or otherwise, would think that there's something radical about showing the truth. You could take the position we need to go to war anyway, but my God, don't put your head in the sand and pretend it's not out there. It's like, Trump news.
Well, but
I don't get it.
But the most important thing is all the books we have and all the picture books are about the win. It's about the sort of military aspect. It's the kind of the sexy machismo part.
Right.
This is the book of consequence. This is the book of consequence.
Yeah.
Again, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. I recommend that you get it. I recommend that you share it with a high school student. I think that would be the best.
Yeah.
How do we end this program, sir?
We end with War Is Not the Answer.
Which is why you have to have this book.
Chuck Green.
And you will understand why war is not the answer.
Correct.
All right, everyone, the Tuesday edition of The Attitude.
Not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Think of all the weapons we make around the world, investing brains and money in the best ways how to kill. If we could use that money for the betterment of man and care about each other, there'd be peace throughout the land. War is not the answer, never.